You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The title story of Cynthia Ozick's new quartet of novellas, Dictation, imagines the influence that the secretaries of Henry James and Joseph Conrad might have had on the legacies of the literary masters. Cynthia Ozick was a guest on the show a few months ago, and I always enjoy talking with her, so we thought that we would air it again for you today. I began by asking her what drew her to the format of the novella, which has a reputation for being harder to market for publishers. Does a novella usually start off as a short story and then grow like Topsy?
It is the latter, definitely. But then, you know, this is, I suppose, the moment when one should quote Henry James and speak of the blessed nouvelle. But it doesn't come from the blessed nouvelle. It comes from writing a story that won't stop and won't go long enough to be a novel. Mm. That's exactly right.
Well, you make a decision when you write a novel to throw in digressions and do all sorts of other things, and you really wanted to remain focused with these pieces.
Yes, it is very different from a novel. The concentration is different. But the wonderful thing about it, and I think we see it in Alice Munro, is that the long short story can leave you with a sense that you've read an entire Tolstoyan novel sometimes. Well, especially if it's Alice Munro.
Yes. And her stories are getting longer and longer. Didn't you write your master's thesis on Henry James?
I confess I did. The later novels of Henry James. Yes.
Is this, as one reviewer has suggested, your revenge on Henry James?
I never thought of it as revenge, but there has been a kind of James-Conrad debate or rivalry in my life recently, where I have been persuaded to convert from James to Conrad. And I guess I did convert. I do have my lapses, though, but I have converted.
And that's because you once wrote Art and Ardor. James represents art to some degree and Conrad ardor, or is
well,
there something
else? I think they both represent both art and ardor. But and I think they both have the same kind of passionate insight into what we can call the nature of evil. But then, you know, Conrad does have the advantage of getting out of the parlor and going to sea.
Even before, yes. James always remained in the parlor.
Always.
But were they rivals in real life?
They were not rivals. They were friends. Cool friends, each behind the scenes having rather stringent criticism of the other. And as they got to know each other, as the years went by, I think they cooled more and more because they had these, each one had a reservation about the other.
But we see that, it seems to me that whenever I look through the history of literature, we see this sort of thing happening again and again, whether it's Richardson and Fielding, whether it's Updike and Mailer, and I'm sure that they got along perfectly well, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Mm-hmm. And arguments can be made for both.
Yes, it's this kind of split in the literary brain. And I don't think the split is between art and ardor. I'm not sure exactly how to identify that split. One may be more insinuating, more cautious than the other. I think they get to the same place, but or you might say one is more direct than the other. I mean, Dostoevsky has a kind of directness which is so different from Tolstoy's own directness, so they're both direct.
Although they really did dislike each other.
Mm.
This story takes place in the early 1900s. They have both hired typists, which were called typewriters at
yes,
the time.
Yes.
Is this based on historical fact?
Well, I have a friend in London who is obsessed with Conrad, possessed by Conrad, and has done research. He is the one who claims, by the way, to have converted me to Conrad. I don't know how honorable or honest my conversion is. As I say, I frequently lapse back into James. But in the course of his obsession, he has done new scholarship, and he began to uncover, really to unearth, Lillian Hallows, who was the, quote, typewriter, typist, amanuensis for Conrad. And I read what he wrote about her. There isn't a great deal. And I saw her picture, and she's quite old maidish and spinsterish, and out of her picture flowed the Lillian Hallows that that I came to know as I wrote. But Theodora, I don't know how to pronounce her last name. I'm not sure anyone alive on the earth today knows how to pronounce it. How do you pronounce her last name?
Well, it's either Bosanquet, which would be the British, or Bosanquet if we decide to give it the French version.
That's right. And I
was a Theodora Bosanquet?
Oh, indeed. And we know a lot about her. Leon Adele speaks of her, not at length, but she makes several appearances in his great biography of James. And she had a college education, and she later wrote many books, biographies, and she was distinguished on her own. And she also wrote a memoir of working with James. So we know much more about her.
Well, we can assume that Joseph Conrad was in constant torment because he always was fighting writer's block. Was James as well?
Never writer's block for Henry James.
They just poured out. You have taken some liberties with the historical record, characters who couldn't have lived at the time. But were they actually writing on the Jolly Corner, working on the Jolly Corner, James and Conrad, the Secret Chair, at the same time?
Yes, very close in time, almost identically in the same time period. So that works. But then, you know, I have Leslie Stephen turning up at the Reform Club. I believe it's 9 years after he died. I didn't know that then until later.
You could have made it somebody else, but why? It's fiction.
Oh, no, I wouldn't want it to be somebody else because his daughter Ginny was with him. And all we know about Theodora is that James at one point in a letter calls her the boyish Miss Bosanquet. So that was a hint, I think.
And Ginny Stevens, of course, is Virginia Woolf.
Yes.
Now, this had to be fun to write because you have kind of adopted the styles of James and Conrad without becoming either of them. This is not a Rich Little thing, but we do feel we're reading something from that time period.
Yes, I did enjoy that, and it came quite easily. If you're steeped in that time and in that style, it came quite easily.
Now, how much are we to get from these secretaries, these typewriters, and the people they worked for? And I don't want to give away the plot, but this is a story about artistic originality as much as anything else.
Well, it is interesting to think about when you are living day after day for many, many hours, in a sense, inside the mind of a writer of the kind James was and Conrad was, and their voices are continually resounding in your head, and you are becoming, in a sense, a double for them. I think I didn't make use of this image, but they are a kind of carbon paper for the dictators whose words they're transcribing. So there has to be some kind of duplication, some kind of impression, some kind of even typographical, let's call it, impression on their brains as they interrelate day after day with these amazing creatures.
My guest is Cynthia Ozick, whose latest book is called Dictation for Novellas. By the way, I want to congratulate you because you just received the Penn Nabokov Award.
Yes, thank you.
That is quite wonderful. It is an international prize that honors the career of world of important fiction writers. And, you definitely have achieved that. I'm paraphrasing here, but you were quoted as having said that early in your career you had to choose between the messy realities of ordinary life and the exclusive dedication to art. Is that something you were thinking about while you were writing this story?
I think that's a very...
Or these stories.
I think that's a very old thought. I think the succinct way to put it is that life interrupts, as it always does.
The second story novella here is called Actors. Did you see it as being part of the same theme? Were you still thinking about?
No, these stories were all written at different times, different stages in my life. Dictation is the most recent, and What Happened to the Baby is also quite recent, about a year and a half old, 2 years old, and the others are very old. So there really is no conscious relationship among them.
Other than they were four novellas and they fit nicely into a book.
Yes.
You once asked, why do I, who dread the cannibal touch of story making, lust after stories more and more?
I don't any longer.
Well, that's changed. Although, you see, I get the sense that that's some of these characters are like that. They lust after stories.
I think that is part of the human condition, to lust after stories, even if it's only gossip, even if it's only the most quotidian, what happened? What went on there yesterday? I think we are story-lusting creatures, yes.
Well, Frank Castle, the protagonist of one of the stories, reread The Heart of the Matter 100 times, weeping. Mm-hmm. Matt Sorley, the protagonist of Actors, worshipped Shakespeare and Oscar Wilde. Annette Sorensen, in one of the other stories, had read most of Edna St. Vincent Millay's verse by heart. Lillian Hallows had Joseph Conrad's work imprinted on her heart, where they are to remain even after her death. But then Annette Sorensen gives up her passion for drama and enrolls as a finance major, and Lillian Hallows betrays Joseph Conrad.
Well, I don't think Lillian is really betraying Conrad. She's betraying Mrs. Conrad. I think also Lillian lusts in her heart after Conrad. She's certainly enamored of him, and Mrs. Conrad doesn't like it. Of course, this is all invented.
We have about 4 minutes to go, but there's a segment that we asked you to read from page 15.
Oh.
Would you just read a little bit of it?
I'd be happy to.
Because I think this gives us an insight into some of the things we've been talking about.
Which segment would that be? Let's see. I really wasn't informed of
this. Oh, gee, well, then maybe we shouldn't do it. It was about the... where you define the notions that James and Conrad have each other, describing their respective secretaries, Miss Hallows and Miss Bussin. Okay, I'm going to give it a French
here.
Name.
Yes, I see. Miss Hallows had seen, was constantly seeing into the blackest recesses of Conrad's mind. She was privy to his hesitations, his doubts, his reversals, and certainly his excitements. She was in the most crucial sense his double, since everything that came out of him she instantly duplicated on the machine. His thoughts ran straight through her, unchanged, unmitigated, unloosed. Without doubt, the same was true with respect to James and the spirited Miss Bosanquet. Every vibration of James's sensibility ran through the woman who served and observed. How could it be otherwise? These two, Miss Hallows and Miss Bosanquet, brought together even momentarily, could only mean exposure.
I haven't mentioned one thing about these stories. They're often laugh-out-loud funny. You know, I don't know. I think that when we talk about the themes of them, that's not something that would immediately come to mind. And yet, you really write very funny things. Is that something that just comes out?
I wish I knew they were funny when I'm writing them, because it seems to me when I write that I'm very solemn, very sober, very serious, and I'm never aware of... writing in any comic fashion, and I'm sure I don't know what that means, that I'm not aware of it.
This is something that other people tell you, gee, that was funny?
Yes, this happens, and then I find myself bewildered and haven't been able to figure it out. So what this means about obtuseness of the writer, I'm not quite sure.
Well, but there even are those little things like Matt Sorley, who's the actor, or at least the stage name of the actor, is called Matt Sorley by people who don't like him. But there are descriptions of people. One person described as kind of having the head of a Q-tip, if I remember correctly. I don't know. There were just things that I found startling and thought, gee, Cynthia's having so much fun here.
Occasionally I do have fun. A pun like Sorley, the name Sorley and Surly, that's not real. That doesn't count as comedy.
Okay, but
low
comedy. Did you know that you were going to call him Surly when you came up with Sorley?
No, that surprised me. Right. And also when his wife, who works on crossword puzzles, creates crossword puzzles, she has a pun, and I guess that amused me, but I don't think that's high comedy either. She speaks of her work, which she doesn't enjoy, as Grid and Barrett.
Yes.
Low pun.
well, as somebody who loves puns, I think they're just fine. Are you working on a novel or more short stories?
Not short stories, but a novel, yes.
Mm-hmm. Totally different kinds of theme?
Entirely different. And if anyone could find humor in what I'm working on now, I would truly be surprised.
Well, you say that what fiction can provide is discernment, penetration, imagination, self-knowledge, but I suspect you don't give that to your characters all the time.
Characters, I think, represent the less lucky sides of ourselves. I think they represent sometimes, perhaps often, the fear that we have, the doubt, the lack of self-confidence, you know, all the dark corridors in the writer.
Cynthia Ozick's latest book, Dictation, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.